This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
New drugs are getting through the FDA approval process faster. According to a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, in January 2020, titled FDA Approval and Regulation of Pharmaceuticals 1983 to 2018, the review time for standard new drug applications, NDAs, was more than 36 months in 1983. In 2018, the review time had decreased to approximately 10 months for standard review NDAs and to 7.6 months for priority review NDAs, arguably as a result of user fees paid by industry to FDA under the 1992 PDUFA law, and in good measure, thanks to the greater use of expedited development and approval pathways, which were used in 81% of new drugs approved in 2018. These expedited pathways have brought treatments to market faster. But there are also concerns that some of these speedy approvals may drive up healthcare costs or bring products to market that are less safe or less effective than they would be if non-expedited procedures had been used. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the IA Global Forum. My guests today are the lead author of the study, Dr. Jonathan Darrow, a pharmaceutical policy expert and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Darrow.
It's great to be here.
And Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, who wrote an editorial that accompanied the study. He is a former FDA Principal Deputy Commissioner and is now a Vice Dean and Professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore. Welcome to you as well, Dr. Sharfstein.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you both for joining us today, and congratulations on being published in JAMA. And let's dig right in. Dr. Darrow, let me ask you first. Today, there are more treatments available to patients and caregivers than ever before, and new treatments are coming to market more quickly than ever before. So isn't that a good thing?
So it's important to recognize that overall, drugs are not actually coming to market more quickly. What's happening more quickly is the FDA review of the drugs, but that is the final 10% or so of the process, maybe taking 6 months to a year or so. So it can be a good thing for drugs to reach the market faster if those drugs offer large benefits. This is occasionally the case, but much more often, drugs offer only very small benefits over existing treatments. I can cite a 2017 study published in Health Affairs, which found that 29% or almost a third of new drugs perform no better than existing treatments, and some fraction of those were actually worse. And that's a generous figure, in part because the authors of that study, it was a gentleman named with the last name of Chambers, considered even the smallest of benefits to be an improvement. They used a measure called the quality adjusted life year, or a QALY, and they considered drugs that have 2/1,000th of a QALY to be an improvement. Other studies have found similar results. There was a 2019 study by Professor Mark Rodwin. He reviewed the official evaluations by the French government of drugs approved between 2009 and 2016. That disclosed that approximately 60%, 60% of new drugs had zero improvement, and less than 1 in 60 offered a major improvement. So the vast majority of drugs being approved and marketed are offering modest, or in some cases, no benefits over existing treatments.
So is FDA approving drugs that maybe should not be approved?
So this is actually a common misunderstanding of the public. I think many people do not recognize that the statutory framework does not require new drugs to outperform older drugs. So this is nothing that the FDA is doing wrong. The FDA is approving drugs as provided for under the statutory framework, which does not require those drugs to outperform older drugs.
Dr. Sharfstein, as a former deputy commissioner at FDA, do you have a view on this point?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that there are many patients with diseases that at the moment are untreatable who very much are interested in great drugs being approved, and they have every right to be. We should have a system that is efficient in producing as many great new medications and devices that the science allows. The challenge we have is that, just like Jonathan said, there are some really great products getting approved and others that provide more marginal benefits, but the price and the cost to our system is enormous. And so the point that I was trying to make in the editorial is not that we have to necessarily throw everything out, that we should risk, you know, major, major disruptions in access to drugs, not at all, but that we should recognize that the system we have is sort of a patchwork. It's kind of a thicket of various policies, and that we can take a step back and say, are there ways to do this better? Are there ways so that we can actually align incentives more so that we have more money to spend for treatments that really would make a huge difference for people who need them?
Thank you. And we'll come back to that point a bit later. Dr. Darrow, let me come back to you. In the article in JAMA, you wrote, quote, "The FDA has increasingly accepted less data and more surrogate measures and has shortened its review times. Is that a problem?"
So we report a couple of data points related to that issue. One is that the number of trials that were non-randomized increased from 4% to 17% over the period that we looked at. There was also an increase in the number of approvals based on surrogate endpoints. That was now 59.3% between 2015 and 2017, up from 44.3% just a few years earlier. So those changes can potentially be problematic if they tend to make drugs look more promising than they actually are. And some evidence suggests this to be the case. For example, a 2015 paper by Vinay Prasad showed that 3 out of 4 surrogate endpoints used in the approval of oncology treatments were not highly correlated with clinical endpoints. So when you have clinical endpoints that are, you know, not highly correlated with the surrogates that you're using, that creates greater uncertainty and makes it more difficult to know whether a drug that you're taking is actually providing a benefit.
So to follow up on that, Dr. Darrow, in your opinion, what problems arise when FDA relies perhaps too much on surrogate endpoints as stand-ins for actual patient benefit, such as well-documented better survival rates, for example? Are regulators approving drugs that sometimes are very highly priced too rapidly, such that payers might refuse to reimburse them because the evidence is just not strong enough to justify a high price?
I think the problem is that you can end up treating patients based on hope, right? Hope that the surrogate endpoint will correlate with a clinical endpoint. There has to be some level of evidence to support a reasonable belief that those two things correlate, but in some cases, that reasonable belief will turn out to be wrong. So now you really have two layers. You are now really two layers removed from what you care about. Not only might the surrogate endpoint not correlate, but even if it does, the amount of the benefit, again, might be small. So really the issue here, in my view, is not evidence or speed of approval. The issue is efficacy. And these two concepts are often conflated. So, for example, you could have overwhelming evidence that a drug offers a 1% improvement, or slim evidence that a drug offers 1% improvement. So that is the shift to less evidence that we describe in the paper. But what we mention only briefly in the paper is much more important, not how much evidence, but how much efficacy. And so even if you have a surrogate endpoint that correlates very well with efficacy, it's not clear that the magnitude of the efficacy is going to be of great importance itself. So with respect to payers, this is difficult. It's difficult for payers to refuse reimbursement because patients don't necessarily understand or care that a price is far out of proportion to the amount of the benefit. And so that's why I think we tend to see formulary policies such as higher copayments or pre-authorization requirements rather than outright exclusions from coverage. And in many cases, payers can't refuse because coverage is legally required.
That would be the case for Medicare, for example?
Exactly. There are 6 categories of drugs under Medicare for which coverage is required, including oncology treatments.
Dr. Shafstein, your opinion as a former regulator on this point?
I think that it is also not surprising that others are putting limitations on the use of certain medications if the evidence base is weak. And more generally, I think that the challenge that the agency has is that it doesn't necessarily know in advance, you know, how well a surrogate endpoint is going to perform. Having said all that, though, I think that we have to realize that this really relates fundamentally to the agency's scientific judgment. You know, when is a single-arm trial appropriate? And there are some situations where it may well be appropriate because you're dealing with a very strong rationale for a very effective treatment for a disease that's uniformly fatal. And in those circumstances, that may be appropriate, and particularly with some kinds of treatment that may be appropriate. when is a particular surrogate measure appropriate? You know, surrogate measures like viral load turned out to really accelerate the development and approval of medications for HIV. So I think that this is an area, again, where personally, I wouldn't throw out surrogate measures. I think it's really important to make sure that there's the best science brought to the thinking of this and that there's, you know, a perspective brought that what we want to do is get better at this. So we're less likely to use surrogate measures that don't work very well and more likely to use surrogate measures that really are able to accelerate the development of important products.
I'm staying with you, Dr. Sharfstein. Do you know of examples where FDA has approved a new drug based on surrogate measures and payers, at least those that are not mandated by law to reimburse it, have refused to reimburse it on the grounds that the evidence was, in their opinion, not sufficient?
Well, that happens. You know, this issue of payers happens all the time with devices. You know, with devices, there are products that get cleared and the payers say, there's just no way that we believe this is really a benefit. And so, you know, that leads to all these thoughts about, well, can FDA work more closely with CMS to align the reviews and that sort of thing. But fundamentally, the goal is for drugs not to become like devices in that respect, where it's just a whole other set of studies that have to be done. It'd be much better for this to be done very well in the first place. You know, one thing I wrote about in the editorial as a way to potentially better align the incentives would be to say for drugs that are based on surrogate endpoints, you know, in an accelerated approval, that they are not allowed to charge market rates, that they would basically be charging costs during that period. And that would allow the development to move forward and some measure of reimbursement, but that much better data would have to be available before companies could go back to charging the standard prices. And that was a proposal that really, I think, at least in the policy community, has bipartisan support.
Going back to a point that I think you were making, would it make sense to actually align regulators and the payer community, understanding that FDA is not allowed to get into pricing? I know that. But would it make sense to align those two constituencies and the sponsors during development to make sure that the studies that are conducted tend to address the needs of the regulators and the payers more or less at the same time? Is there any merit to trying to do that?
Well, I think in devices, because there's such a divide between clearance and reimbursement, it is important to do that. For drugs, I think the kinds of things that I wrote about in the editorial or suggested here to just get a better, more efficient process for producing meaningful medical products, I think is the core problem. I mean, you could bring in insurers who will basically say that, or you can agree and start to look at the drug approval process and take some reasonable steps to improve the effectiveness of it.
Staying with you, Dr. Sharfstein, and your editorial, you wrote that despite the user fees and the use of expedited pathways, over the last three decades, the rate of new drug approvals has not increased, while the duration of clinical development has not decreased and seems to actually have increased. So what are your thoughts on this apparent discrepancy?
Well, I think I was quoting from the study by Dr. Darrow there. And I think that is at a very, very high level because you're looking at all of the different drugs. You're looking at, you know, many different kinds of products all mixed together. So I think partly in my editorial, I was saying that it's not that easy to know exactly what that means. It certainly doesn't suggest that we've seen inexorable progress from those particular measures, but that from my view, it probably illustrates that we're not necessarily in the best of all possible worlds. And we can roll up our sleeves and look and say, you know, where can we maybe pare back some of the incentives and maybe dial up some other things and, you know, really be thoughtful about a system that could be more effective at doing what it needs to do.
Dr. Darrow, apologies. I was indeed quoting from your study. I'm sorry about that. Please weigh in on this point and the quote that I referred to a few moments ago.
So this is difficult. The hope is that all of the expedited programs that have been introduced have helped to more efficiently process new drugs through the drug development pipeline. And it is somewhat discouraging that neither the number of new drugs has gone up, nor has the duration of clinical development gone down. That's overall. So I agree with Dr. Sharfstein that it's hard to interpret this at such a high level. It is true that if you look at specific components components, there have been improvements. So for example, it is generally agreed and non-controversial that user fees have been effective in reducing FDA review times. We also see shorter overall development and review times for drugs that are in certain expedited programs, especially the breakthrough therapy program, suggesting that that has been effective or at least correlated with drugs having shorter development and review times. But it's also true that overall clinical development times across all drugs have not clearly decreased. So we speculate briefly about the causes in the JAMA publication, but ultimately we don't know why that has not been able to be shortened. It could be due, for example, to an increased focus on orphan indications where patient recruitment can sometimes take longer. It could be due to tackling more difficult disease categories, or it could be that drugs are failing to show benefit in the indications that are first tested. And so it may take longer to find a particular subgroup or indication where the drug shows benefit. But all of this is just speculation. Ultimately, we don't know why.
Some people have suggested that in recent decades, protocols have become vastly more complex than they had been previously. Do you think this might be a factor?
Well, what we've seen is that there has been an increasing number of single-arm trials, a reduction in the number of blinded trials, an increase in the number of non-randomized trials. So all of those things I would not describe as more complex clinical trial designs. If anything, those are simplified trial designs. But it's certainly possible that trial design has become more complex in other ways that we have not measured.
Final question, Dr. Sharfstein, let me ask you first. Do we need any changes in the legislation or regulation of new drugs and biologics for the purposes of reducing uncertainty about the safety and clinical benefits of a new treatment without, anyway, slowing down patient access to medicines they need?
I think that the purpose of changes in regulation and law would be to enhance patient access to treatments that really make a difference. And it is the purpose would be to do that and do it perhaps at an overall lower cost than a system that creates a lot of approvals for drugs that may have marginal benefit, but a very high sticker price. That would be the purpose. And I do think it's a good idea. I think that it's important to bring a pen, not a pruning shear, to the discussion so that it's really a question of rethinking and improving the system as it exists rather than just tossing out drug approval and all the work that's gone into it. I think it's a process that should recognize the tremendous scientific understanding and judgment that I think many scientists at FDA have. But I do think it's a good idea. And I hope that FDA can lead that process in many ways by looking in the mirror and trying to figure out what parts of this complicated, confusing system are working and which ones could be working better. So in particular, in the editorial, I talked about rationalizing the programs for expedited review, update requirements for fast track and breakthrough status based on a review of how that's gone, strengthening the oversight of post-marketing safety of medications that offer major benefits but also pose serious risks, recalibrate programs that provide companies with special marketing protections, such as the pediatric exclusivity program, which in many cases works just great, but then in some cases gives just a huge outsized benefit for a relatively modest investment. Congress should use patent and pricing incentives to accelerate the generation of definitive evidence under accelerated approval, as I mentioned before. So I wouldn't in any way concede that this is about slowing down approval of medications that people need. I think it's about making it more likely that medications coming to the FDA are going to have a big impact, and also about the fact that society can afford, ultimately, that the people who really need them can get them.
Dr. Darrow, a final thought on Dr. Sharfstein's proposed reforms?
I think the single most important reform that's needed is to more clearly label drugs with an understandable measure of their benefit. And I would point to the example of SPF and sunscreen, which is an FDA-regulated product, although not usually thought of as a drug. It's labeled with a clear indication of its benefit. And if you look what's happened in the sunscreen market, SPF measures have increased dramatically since the 1970s. We need similar market pressure for drugs, and right now we don't have it. Physicians and patients, particularly those who have serious or life-threatening diseases or conditions, are very willing to try drugs that offer any benefit, no matter how small, no matter how certain, and no matter how high the price. To some extent, I think that the way that you asked the question reflects both a common view, but also an underlying problem with pharmaceutical policy that we have today, which is that it implies that new drugs are must-haves that cannot wait. We cannot slow down the process and make patients wait any longer than they have to. That may be true for a tiny number of drugs, such as AIDS medications in the 1980s. It's not true for the vast majority of new treatments. For new drugs that don't offer large benefits, I think the evidence amply demonstrates that is most of them, it's okay if you slow down patient access, wait until you have sufficient data, and then label those treatments to clearly communicate to patients what those benefits are. For the small number of drugs that remain, you want evidence that the drugs actually offer benefit, large benefit, not just hope that they might.
That brings us to the end of our conversation. Dr. Darrow, thank you very much. Congratulations again on your article, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Sharfstein, thank you very much for your contribution and insights today as well.
Thank you for having me.
For DIA Global Forum, I'm Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.